This is the Steve Gruber Show. Sitting in today for Steve is Scott Bertram.
Actually, kind of a thin day in music today. Birthdays and events. Happy birthday, Michael Ward, guitarist with the Wallflowers. During their most prosperous period, their most successful period, that late 90s, one headlight we hear there, Michael Ward, guitarist with the Wallflowers. And he turns 52 years old today, no longer with the band, but was there when they were making big hits. Michael Ward, 52. Scott Bertram sitting in for Steve here on the Steve Gruber Show. And Noah Rothman, associate editor at Commentary, also MSNBC and NBC News contributor. Brand new book, Unjust Social Justice and the Unmaking of America, is just out and available now. Noah actually on the Hillsdale campus this week. And sat down with him actually yesterday to chat about the book Unjust. Noah, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So we go to the book, Noah, on social justice, and I will tell you, finished it, and there is a lot of great ideas and a lot of great arguments in this book. We'll try to dig into as many as we can during our short time. You write early on about the religious near religious zeal with which social justice is considered with some of its proponents. Do you think that is because it's in some ways a replacement for religion for those people?
I mean, it's entirely possible. The religiosity in this concept is not a figment of anybody's imagination. There is sort of a vestigial element of religion to social justice because it was originally a religious concept. It arises out of originally in the Catholic Church's teachings in the mid-19th century as sort of an alternative theory of social organization to compete with the largely secular Scottish and Protestant Enlightenment. But that was much more of an idea about charity and how to think about one's obligations to one's fellow man. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, John Rawls put more meat on these bones, theorizing about justice, thinking about it more as a way to deal with historic inequities and affecting a more fair society. And that's what it more resembles today. But because these concepts are so inviolable and so generally noble and accepted broadly, that they don't encounter much skepticism, particularly when they manifest in ways that are unproductive, counterproductive to the objectives, noble objectives, that social justice advocates adhere to. And so you do encounter a lot of frustration when you challenge these concepts, in part because they haven't been challenged in the past. And that does resemble, in many ways, a sort of secular faith.
You later write, there has been progress in this country. There have been many great things toward racial, social, economic equality in 240 years. This is good news, you write, but good news is often regarded as a display of profound ignorance by the arbiters of political discourse. Why is it so hard to accept that there are good things happening?
Yeah, right. And one of the truths that I identify in the chapter to which about truths to which social justice advocates are so hostile is sort of the self-evident idea that there has been racial progress in this country over the course of the last half century. To take it from that broader perspective, it's pretty self-evident. I mean, the idea that there has been no racial progress from the time in which we were deploying the 101st Airborne on American soil to desegregate schools to the time in which we elected a black president seems like something that wouldn't encounter much resistance. But it does, and not because that is an objective truth that's self-evident, but because it is a display of an idea that can be used by individuals who are hostile to the notion that there is still racial progress to come, that we have a place mm-hmm. to go in this country, and we may never be the more perfect union that we hope to be. Because that truth can be misused, is regarded as a dangerous idea, and so it's met with hostility. But that's a campaign against objectivity. When objectivity becomes the enemy of a political program, it's not objectivity that has to go. There's a fundamental problem in the paradigm here.
Noah Rothman is with us. His new book, Unjust, Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. In the Lifting the Veil chapter, you write, social justice advocates are unconvinced that perfect equality is desirable because such a naive ideal ignores historical injustices. If they're not looking for perfect equality, what's the goal?
Yeah, so perhaps at the end of this utopian stage of development, we get to perfect equality. But in the process, there needs to be some redistribution. And that's why social justice has taken on a character that is in many ways retributive in form. Once upon a time, the ideal for reformers of this type was to effect positive discrimination, positive social leveling, to find individuals with mitigating, extenuating circumstances, identify those circumstances on the individual level and provide some sort of a hand up in order to achieve the sort of status in society that they have been denied by their individual circumstances. Frequently, you don't hear that sort of talk from social justice advocates today. Today, downward social leveling is the objective, a sort of retributive justice meted out to individuals who have benefited from historical conditions of which they may not even be aware. They deserve a comeuppance. Their privileges, quote, need to be checked. And that's a sort of retributive, vengeful philosophy that advocates downward social leveling. And I use the Vonnegut story Harrison Bergeron to illustrate mm-hmm. this, which is sort of he envisioned a society in which individuals with traits that were preferred in society, you know, and somebody who is attractive or more intelligent or athletic would have those abilities debilitated. They would be leveled downward in order to affect a negative social leveling. And that's sort of what you see social justice advocates embracing now in a sort of paradigmatic sense.
In the Violent Delights chapter, you get to the end of the book, it gets a little scary. The left in particular has grown comfortable drawing moral equivalencies between disagreeable speech and physical violence. And I should mention, you write about Charlottesville in here as well, so that is covered. But again, I think it is mainly from the left we start hearing these phrases like speech equals violence, or an appropriate reaction to your speech that I don't like is some violent act, perhaps. We are too close, I'll say that. Can we walk back from where we are at this point in the equivalence of speech and violence?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is a really deeply flawed paradigm, and it's one that has been imposed, I think, on students in particular, who are being taught and trained in, particularly on college campuses, that discomfort, social discomfort, can literally result in physical trauma. And when you begin to think about that in those terms, then a violent response is not only justified, it's self-defense. And that's part of the reason why I think we've seen, and it's not just on college campuses. I mean, you've seen this in the political class, particularly in the early part of this decade under the Obama administration, that you would see sort of tacit justifications for violence mm-hmm. Because of the social discomfort that the targeted individuals had instigated. I mean, they were practically asking for it. I have a variety of examples of that in the book. And this isn't just a purely left-wing phenomenon. The right is very attracted to these ideas as well. The far-right extremes, the fringes, and the racially aware right, the alt-right, and the people who are attracted to those movements, they're mirroring these conditions. I mean, you could say it's a chicken and egg situation, which came first, but it doesn't really matter to me which came first. These are ideas that need to be identified, stigmatized, and isolated.
That's Noah Rothman here on the Steve Gruber Show. Noah, thanks for joining us. His new book is out right now. It's called Unjust. And again, he's been on the Hillsdale campus this week talking to our students and just doing a great job telling them about the business, what he does, Commentary Magazine and at MSNBC and NBC. And, you know, he was a radio guy right out of college. Don't know if you knew that. We thank Noah for it. His time. Coming up next, Jeff Ferry, Research Director at the Coalition for a Prosperous America. He's next on the Steve Gruber Show.
My Pure Health Solutions, formerly Nutrimost, really changed my life. I've lost weight and kept it off, and I feel great. Now it's even easier to make My Pure Health Solutions work for you, anywhere, anytime, from the comfort of your own home. My Pure Health Solutions will build a custom program for you, not artificial shakes and bars, but real food, so you can keep the weight off. I'm telling you, this works. Jared and the team will evaluate your body, create a one-of-a-kind blueprint for you to get healthy, and you never have to leave home. Go to MyPureHealthSolutions.com. MyPureHealthSolutions.com. Do it now.
The Michigan Chamber of Commerce is on the job every day fighting to deliver powerful business advocacy and political action vital to the success of Michigan businesses. The Michigan Chamber of Commerce is working to make Michigan the best state in the country to live, work, raise a family, or build a business by strengthening communities and improving our quality of life. We work to improve workforce readiness and build the entrepreneurial spirit that has powered and defined Michigan for decades. The Michigan Chamber of Commerce, on the job every day fighting for Michigan's future. MIChamber.com.
You're not wired to have a response to this sound. You're neutral to it. You hear it every time you finish a meal and never feel anything. But if we were able to associate this sound with a new stimulus, save the food. We've achieved pulling a natural response from you. Save the food. Why are we doing this, you may ask? Save the food. Because this ad is trying to change your after-meal behavior through brainwashing. Because food waste costs the average family $1,500 a year. Save the food. Cha-ching. And $1,500 extra is like getting a pay raise. Save the food. Cha-ching.
You're promoted.
Which could pay for your child's braces. Save the food. Cha-ching.
You're promoted.
Check out my braces.
So when you hear this sound, rethink your behavior. Cook it, store it, share it. Just don't waste it. For tips and recipes, visit SaveTheFood.com. Brought to you by NRDC and the Ad Council.